This is an oral history interview for the Mill Workers Oral History Project. I'm Andrea Lumgia, and the date is June 23rd, the year 2005. And I'm here with Amy and Aurora
Foisy.
Could I start with you? And okay. Could you state your full name and spell it?
My full name, A-I-M-E, Amy Foisy. F-O-I-S-Y, Foisy.
And where and when were you born? Where and when were you born?
Oh! February 21st, 1919.
Right. And where?
In Auburn. I lived on First Street.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've gone from First Street to 7th.
Yeah, that's right. We went up the hill. It's a good way to go. So, after that, when I was 4, my father left my mother for another woman and went to New Jersey. And my mother had to work at the end of Scoggin to support herself. So she put the 3 of her children in an orphanage on the Ash Street. It's still there. Today it's a place for old people to go to die. Yeah. There's a word for it, but I can't think of it now.
Nursing home.
Anyway, it's not a nursing home. Honey. Then we, I went to the orphanage. I was 4 years old. I stayed there for 7 years, and I come out of there. I can't complain about nothing about the orphanage, because the orphanage, the nuns were absolute saints. And when I was 6 or 7, I think, they let my curly hair grow. Oh yeah, for about 3 or 4 months without giving me a haircut. And they cut it right down to the ball. And they took that one hair at a time and they sewed it on a doll made out of wax. And it represented the baby Jesus at Christmas.
Oh.
Hey, I'll tell you, I've been lucky all my life after that. And I've been through hell a few times. So, after that, I stayed there till 11, and I came out, and I went to live with my mother and my brothers and sister. And I went to work for, I went to school till I was 16 years old. They kept me in the 7th grade instead of putting me in, when I was 16, with the other guys that were 16, into the 8th grade. Well, I got mad on my birthday. I was 16 years old, and kids were allowed to go to work. I went to work for the Progressive Bakery down the hill next to it used to be there.
Yeah.
$4 a week, 12 hours a day. But it was money to be earned. A couple of months later, all my friends were working in a Woodhill plant, and they asked me to come along with them. They had paid $8. That wasn't bad. We only worked about 40 hours. So that wasn't bad. I stayed with that. And when I got to be 18, I became the foreman. How well I got along with everybody. They had very nice people there working for. We were working for two men. One was Brownie and the other one was a Jewish fella. Very nice person. I used to go on trips with him to Vermont to get some maple, hard rock maple, to make heels for women's shoes.
Manny
Mascot. That was his name. Yeah, I'm sure that the people would like to hear his name again, but he must have been gone a long time ago. Anyway,
I'm going to pause just a second. Okay, so you were saying Manny?
Oh, Manny Mascot. Yeah, he was a very nice man, and he was a good guy to work for. They went bankrupt. They run out of money, and they closed the place down. So they, both of them, they took all the stuff that they could get in their car and got out and went to Massachusetts. But we, you know, somebody advised me to get ourselves a lawyer and to get our back pays. And we did. Mm. We got a nice lawyer. He was on Main Street in Auburn here, I remember. And everybody got their pay. So when I got to my pay, it was $25 a week, so I had 3 weeks coming to $75. My wife and I went to a watcher with that, and we really had a good time for a couple of days there. So after that, I came back, and then I was getting in the age to get drafted, and the draft came along. I got drafted. I went to Fort Devens and stayed there for a few days, and a couple of weeks, I think. And then they didn't have the jacket that fits me just right, you know. Mm. So they kept me there, and they had a tailor make my army jacket. Boy, he made it a good job. Beautiful job. It's the best piece of clothes I ever had on my back up to then. And then we stayed there probably 3 or 4 weeks. And another thing happened to me. I had already had my shot 2 weeks earlier, and there was a staff sergeant, because I left after the guys 2 weeks after the other guys because they had my jacket ready. And the guy just kept insisting, you're going to stay in Devens until you get your shot. So he gave me another set of shots, 5 shots. Oh. Holy hell. I got on the, it didn't bother me. I thought, hey, I was going to live forever. So we got on the train and everything. And when we got to Pine Camp, the name of the town is, I can't remember. Anyway, when we got there, I got out and put my duffel bag in front of me, and I passed out right in the snow. The next thing I know, I woke up. It was a day later, and the nurse was sitting in a chair watching me. And it was night, and the nurses were changing, and she was mad with what they had done to me, you know, stupid mistake like that. So as she was turning the corner to go downstairs, she said, they were going to hang that guy if you hadn't come out or woke up. He said, you can be sure of that. Oh, hey, it didn't do anything. I was, half awake and half asleep, so it didn't make any difference. But I could tell that there was big trouble for that poor boy. Mm. But anyway.
Was this 1942?
It was 19, I was drafted, 1942. I was drafted February the 4th, 1942.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just 2 weeks later that I got that double shot. Anyway, they treated me real good. They gave me my PFC right away, and that's where it remained, because I shot my mouth. You know, I mean, you get mad after this top sergeant pushes you around. I hate people put their hands on me. So one morning I was driving to Colonel Dalrymple. Oh, what a nice guy. Real Southern gentleman. Very, very nice man. I never did know his first name, but I know his Colonel Dalrymple. So we were sitting in a Jeep, and he says, well, he says, we've made a choice now that we're going to send you to officer's training school in Fort Belvoir. It's an engineer school. I would have got myself a real good education free. Mm. Oh, boy. Boy, well, I made a mistake, but I lost my noodles anyway. So anyway, I said to the colonel, I don't want no damn thing out of this damn army. All I want is out of this damn army. Well, he says, I'll see to it that you don't get any more. And he did. I was remain a PFC all the way. So that's the way it is. You got to know how to have respect for people. So anyway, I met him all the time, but I kept bribing him. He never said nothing. And I never said nothing either. I was afraid he's going to take my stripe away. So anyway, we stayed at Pine Camp until we left in November. Well, I came home to get married in September from Fort
California.
No, I was in Texas then.
Oh, Texas.
Yeah, there's a name for that fort. Anyway, I was in Texas, and I drove to Chicago, and then I drove back home, and I'd had nothing to eat for those 18 hours. I was just nervous getting married. You know how it is getting married. So
that's why you faint.
Wait till we get to that. All right, everybody. Wait till you hear that. So I got off and the train and went home and met my mother and my brothers, and then I went. I was discharged. Huh? Yeah. That's not the way it happened. I came home
on a 15-day furlough.
A 3-day furlough, right? And I went up to your house to talk about the wedding.
Yeah.
That I remember, and. We went to church in a little chapel in at St. Peter's. There's a little chapel in the back there, and we went to get married. So the priest turns around. He wanted to bless us. I pass out. My wedding. Sorry for a girl who would pass out, but a man, a grown man. Oh, geez, I was mad at myself.
I look at him. I said, Mike, what the hell is he doing? You were on the floor. Oh my God.
So that was pretty good anyway. Then everything straighten itself out, shake ourselves up, eat some food, we'll be all right. And then we left.
You went across the street with my brother
to
get a drink or something.
Yeah.
And the priest was waiting for
the
us.
Priest for us to finish the wedding. Where's the groom?
And I feel like fainting myself, you know, because I saw him. And then we went back, and the priest, I said to myself, hurry up, so we can get out of here. Oh, boy, what a wedding.
Well, we got over that one anyway. Oh, boy. But
and then he went across.
Then I went back to Texas. Because I had to go back there. I promised my word of honor that I would not try to escape because we knew we were going across. Mm. So when I got there, 2 days later, on the trains and go off, we went to a camp in Massachusetts, not Devon, it's another one. Anyway, that was a camp that people left from. The ship went to Halifax, Nova Scotia. They had to pick up a big convoy with aircraft carriers on it. It was one of the biggest convoys they ever put. We had 3 aircraft carriers with us. There was planes buzzing over us all night and all day to make sure, because they had an armored division on there that's expensive, all the tanks and everything. Boy, they had to protect that. So anyway, we got to England January the 12th. That I didn't forget. January the 12th.
1942.
No, it had to be 43 because I was drafted. That's right. It was 43. January the 12th, 1943. Right. Then we stayed in England at. I never thought I'd forget that little name. It was a small village on the outside of. Not Bristol. It's another one. And we. We're only 9 miles away from Bath. There's a Bath, England, too.
Yes.
That's where the Roman baths are, all underneath the big buildings. So we stayed in England from January until June 18th, when we went into after D-Day. D-Day was June the 6th, 12 days later. They had made a place to put an armored division in there. They couldn't take chances. So the infantry, they opened up a place. And the 4th Armored went in. Then we all took our way. We were engineer reconnaissance, myself and the lieutenant. And we went out all by ourselves. Once in a while, they sent an M-18 with us. It was a very nice tank. It was fast. I tried to race one cross country once, and he beat me. We do things like that, you know. So anyway, we kept looking around for to put our tanks across bridges that were safe. We had all kinds of instruments to test things, how good the bridge was and everything. And one other thing that was in France had a lot of crevices running through farmland. That's probably made by earthquake or something, you know. And this is very dangerous for a tank. He gets caught and he's so heavy, he'll break the wall of the crevice that he'll go down. So we used to bring a great big transom to build bridges with, and you put that across the crevice the crevice, and it would hold. The tank would go across, and off they went. So that's what I did most of the time the war, until I got captured going to a hospital, something wrong on my inside. And then I was a prisoner of war for 9 months. Uh-huh. Yeah. And for the time that we spent probably 2 weeks in a prison camp until we were trained to understand what the workings of being a prisoner of war. After we settled in and everything, there was a tech sergeant, American, and he used to put guys to work. I went to work in Munich for a week, and I didn't like it very much, and I told the guy, so they sent me back to the camp. And then that's when we went to a Rohrbach, Germany. It's in the Australian, in the Bavarian Alps. And we didn't know at the time what we were doing. We were cutting logs about 6 feet high, and it had to be at least 6 inches across. So we had a whole bunch of them. We found out at the end. We worked there until, we got out of there in April. Yeah, well, we went through the winter. We started in the winter anyway. And it's funny, but a high place like that, they think there'd be a lot of snow, but there wasn't. There wasn't that much. We could still work in the forest. I had my nice army boots too. And boy, that was good then. Anyway, we worked there for at least 2 or 3 months, and once they brought us out to work at the on the railroad, on the railroad station in Rohrbach, and all of a sudden a big American plane comes over, P-51, and boy, somebody was hiding. Hey, that's Americans there, you bum! The poor guy, something happened to him. He crashed. And he was all burned up. So the Germans told us that he was a black boy. I didn't believe it, because I never knew that they had black boys flying those high-priced airplanes. So he opened the casket, and he didn't just took out his hand. His hand was black. I could see it. I said, okay, he's black. So when that's time, well, don't get ahead of yourself. After that day, they treated him very well as a German soldier, a nice little casket. And we were there to help the guys dig the grave and everything. Then we served as honor guards, and then we buried him. But the important thing was to know where it was. It was a nice churchyard next to a Catholic church. So we knew where it was. So when all of this baloney was all over with, the prisoner of war baloney, we went to Lucky Strike. They had the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Armored Force. That's where we went, the Armored Force, the tanks. That's what's called Lucky Strike. There was Chesterfield, Camel, what was the other one? Anyway, there was the name of cigarettes, yeah. Anyway. So, we stayed there 6 or 7 days, not very long. I was glad because I was coming home after that. But every day we had to go back to the tech sergeant and repeat everything that the information. Mm-hmm. And he had it, and he kept reading it along with us. So we, okay, you're sure you didn't forget nothing now. But they were very worried about finding all the corpses so they can bring them home. It's the least they could do. Well, she lost her brother there. He came home from North Africa. Mm-hmm. They brought him back home. Mm-hmm. And he's buried in the cemetery, St. Peter.
Yeah, he died in
the war. He died in the war. A landmine. The mm-hmm. sergeant that was with us, he said he stepped on a landmine. And there's nothing left of him. No need of opening the casket for anything. And he'd been dead for a year, so there was nothing to see. So after that, we came home. I went to Lake Placid for a month. The Millionaires Lake Placid Club gave that to the returning veterans, but they didn't give it to them. They just rented it. They gave it to them. Just let them use it. Nice big cottages and everything. We could use their golf club. They had horses, and that's where I learned how to run a sailboat. A friend of mine from Belfast, We got together. We had some sailboats, and boy, we sailed right across. When they bombed Japan, all the people running down the street to go to the liquor store to get some liquor. So he said, "Come on, let's take a boat." We went right across. We were the first ones there. Well, at least we got a couple of bottles anyway. We sold them when we got back and made some money with it. Anyway, we stayed there for about a week, I think, something like that. Mm-hmm. Then they shipped us back to our original camp, which was Fort Belvoir, right mm-hmm. outside of Washington, D.C. I stayed there and I drove a colonel to the Army place in Washington, D.C. every day. I parked the car. I couldn't use the car. But you know what was nice about Washington, D.C. when we were there? We could hail a cab and tell them where we wanted to go. They never charged us nothing. Hmm. Yeah, never charged us nothing. Of course, we had our medals hanging on us, you know, and you know how it is. Heroes, baloney. Nobody's a hero. Just stay alive. That's all. That's what counts. Yeah, that's true, you know. Survival is the most important thing. It's probably important in regular life, but it's even more important when you're a prisoner of war. Believe me. At night, we were trying to sleep, and the Germans had captured the Cossacks, great big swords and white horses. When they captured them, they brought them into their army, and they made them, I don't know if there's a word for it, but they made them to catch the deserters from the German army. Mm. And they said, if they give you any bad words, cut their heads off. And that's what they did. We found one when we were going from our billet to the place we were. We found one that was down in the gully there. So we reported it to the guys that were working, the German guys that were working with us. They sent somebody to pick up the body. Mm. Well, that's terrible, you know. Mm. But those lousy Russians. Anyway, I thought that was the worst thing that you could do to a human being, cut his head off. Anyway, after that, well, we went back to Fort Belvoir, and I got discharged from that October the 23rd. October the 23rd, 1944. Right. Geez, that all happened in 1944. Anyway, I'm just asking myself questions. Yeah. I mean, after all, I'm not that good at it. I'm 86, honey. So then I went to Fort Belvoir, and I stayed there maybe 30 days until I had 82 numbers. You have to have 84 to get up. So when they got to 82, it was my turn to go out. It was October the 23rd. It was on a Saturday, I think, when I got home. I got all the way to Portland. It was about midnight at night. All the way to Portland on a train. Then all the buses were closed. It was after midnight. I couldn't get it home. I couldn't get home. I said, hell, I've hiked this before, 30 miles. That ain't that much. So I took my duffel bag and I started walking. So this big truck, beep, beep, beep. What are you doing walking? What else do you want me to do? There's no buses. Get in here, he says. Where are you going? He says, I'm going to Lewiston. Good, well, I'm going right by there. I'll take you home. Hey, boy, did I pray the good Lord, thank you. I didn't want to get caught walking. Anyway, I got home, it was probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, I think. Woke up my mother. She was glad to see me, 1 o'clock or not. And the next day, I just got to tell her about that. The next day, I used to live on 313 Lisbon Street. It's probably a 5-minute walk down through the Bleachery. That's where and I knew she was coming down from upstairs on Birch Street and come down that way. So I'm going to go right on the corner and catch her. So I walk over there. I waited not longer than 2 or 3 minutes, and there I see her coming down. It was a whole bunch of girls. It's all girls working in there. So I grabbed them and I just...
You didn't tell me was you going to come home, you know. And I was working at Pebble, you know. So I was walking with a girl, you know. And I saw him over there. I said, don't tell me that's him. Oh, my goodness. I didn't know what to do. I stopped running.
All the girls were laughing and clapping their hands. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite a rendezvous.
What a surprise. He didn't even tell me that he was coming home.
What a surprise, you know.
Wow. I haven't seen him for 2 years. Well, he was in the army, you know. And we got better on a furlough, so. And I was living with my mother, you know.
I think this is a good time to ask you a few questions.
Yeah. And go ahead, honey.
Catch up to where you are. Can you say and spell your full name?
A-U-R-O-R-E. Aurora. That's it.
Foisy.
Foisy.
F-O-I-S-Y.
It used to be Parody.
Parody was your maiden name?
That's right. Yeah.
And what was your birth date?
November 28, 1920.
And were you born in the Lewiston, Auburn area?
No, I was born in Canada, Saint-Hélène-de-Bicraville. I was 2 years old when we came, when we got down here, you know. And we were 14, the family.
14 kids?
14 kids.
Wow.
And we came back in a train, you know. And we all went on the park, in the park. And they put us on the paper that day, a big family from Canada.
Oh, wow.
So,
what did your parents do for work when they got here?
Oh, my father, he went to work at the mill, at the Scoggin Mill.
Oh.
And my mother, well, she didn't work. You know.
Right, because she had 14 kids.
14 kids, yeah.
You better believe she worked. Huh?
she worked at home, all right. Yeah. So, that's my life, I guess. I work at Pepro for 10 years. And I work in the shop, and then I met him in the shop.
The shoe shop.
He was a little boss of floor.
Yeah, I was the boss of the ladies' room.
That's where I met him. Yeah. And I was only 17 years old when I met him. Then I went out with him for about 3 years before the war, and then he went to the service. And when he was in the service, he said, "Let's get married." So we got married on a furlough, And then he came home. He went to work at the mill.
Yep, right off. I came out on a Friday and Sunday night. I was on a third shift working in the Hill Mill. Yep.
Wow. How did you get back into the mill so quickly?
My brother was working there, and he brought me right in. And as soon as the big wheel, what was his name anyway?
Well, he was a little boss, Joe.
Joe, well, not then, he was a loom fixer then, but he did become an executive. Wormsley came up to meet Mr. Wormsley. He was the super. And he came up to me and he says, "I understand that you were a prisoner of war." I says, "Yes." Well, he says, "If there's anything you need and you can't get it from anybody else, come and see me." That's a good welcome home. Yeah. So, I did well at the Hill Mill. I eventually became a loom fixer. And then they brought in some new looms. And they had the guy from Draper with me. And he taught me everything there was to about those looms. So then they took me as the instructor for loom fixers. I trained about 13, 14 loom fixers in the Hill Mill in the period that I was there. I worked 38 years for Bates.
Yeah.
3 years for Bates when the Hill Mill closed. So I'd worked 35 years for the Hill Mill. Yep. So anyway, that was very, very good. I used to make good money, and they couldn't pay me for being an instructor. So what they did, they gave me 4 hours overtime every night. I didn't do nothing. I just stayed in the mill. But boy, I had a pay out there. That's when I bought this place.
Yeah.
I had
a
real good pay.
I was working two shifts.
Yeah, I know.
A lot of overtime.
Yeah, well, that's the only way to make money.
So,
Bates treated me very well. Although I was a union officer for most of the time that the union was there, one way or another, I was shop steward for I don't know how many years. And I always tried to be reasonable with the company when we went to the office to debate some certain issues. And I always made sure that we didn't go across the line. There's a line that you can go beyond, and it's insulting then that you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to inform them, and that's it. There's a lot of guys there.
What sort of issues came up over the years for workers in the mill that you took to the management?
Well, it's several things. The insurance, they had a hard time to get that out of them. The insurance, and it was very important to us. Yeah. And that started people buying insurance for Medicare, for medical, you know. When the union boys had it, why the hell I'm somebody else get it, you know? So it was a good movement. They had it at Prepro too, insurance, hospital insurance. And then naturally the hospitals were happy. Nope, don't have to worry about guys who are working. They're making money. They got insurance. So they always took good care of us. So other issues, though, when they put the uniforms on, Bobbins used to come from upstairs in the spinning room, and they came ready. And, they had a battery hand. They used to put in a battery, great big battery. It used to go around. There was 62. To empty it, you had to 62 times. It came down and put it in there. The loom used to run about 180 picks a minute. And it's dangerous. I mean, it's anything at all, just that shuttle took out. One hit me in the stomach and I fainted once. So, and it was my fault. I didn't push it all away. Wise guys. Anyway, those things happen. What else? They put the uniforms on there. Then there was some squawking about Lumphus fixing the uniforms. Well, then we had to go to the office. She says, I told the manager, that says, it's a good thing for you and it's a good thing for us. But we're not going to take the uniform. You call us Lumphuses, that's what we are. But we're not going to touch that uniform. You're going to put one man on each shift that knows those uniforms perfectly and can fix them. Well, he says, I've given you everything else, so much as well give you that. Okay. He was a nice person. Emery, his last name was. The last time I saw him, he was in...
At the meeting?
The home we went to see there.
Schooner
Fair. He was there. That's where he died, the poor guy. So he was a very nice person. He loved his loom fixes because they kept the mill running.
Can you talk to me some more? Describe what your job was.
I had 120 looms to take, 100 looms to take care of. They had to keep running all the time. And when they're down, we've got to see to it that the boss knew about it and the weaver got paid for it. The down loom. Okay. So then we got to go over to that loom and fix it. And it takes a good 2 years to learn everything that you should know about it. So after a while, it's a real nice business. I probably had 6 jobs in 8 hours. It was real good. They were nice new looms too, and I made sure they stayed new. You have to buy some parts. I told him a couple of times, that's been missing for 2 weeks. At the supply room. And the guy used to be mad at me all the time. But that's all right. We got the looms running and the weavers made their money. Made the money they're supposed to make. They made almost as much as loomfuss as weavers. A good weaver could keep his looms going. And I had a young lady, she used to live up here. She used to work me on a weaver's set. Very nice lady too. So
then you was a loom fixer.
Yeah. So we did something, and I had a lot to do with it. The Loom Fixers Association. You probably never heard about it. So the Western Auburn Loom Fixers Association. It's a club of our own. The union was afraid that we were starting just a loom fixers union, and we kept telling them. And I was a good friend of Denny. I used to work
Denny
for
Bray.
Coach. Denny Blair. Yeah. You know him?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Is he still living?
He was as the last I knew, but I haven't known recently.
How long ago was that?
Oh, maybe 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he's dead.
No, because I've never seen it in the paper.
I've seen it in the paper. Yeah. I think his wife is dead.
Oh, his wife is dead. I know that.
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah.
So, I know she was sick a while.
Oh, yeah, she was very sick. Yeah. Nice lady, too. So I went to Denny and I told him, I said, hey, they want to make a new job, and I'm the one that's going to get it. He said, it has nothing to do with that. He said, they're not supposed to have any conference with you. They're supposed to have conference with us in the office here. Another guy was going to run me, but he had my nose, just like the boss in the mill. Okay, we'll do it your way. So when the agent, when I told that to the agent, he said, from now on, you're going to make 4 hours overtime every night. Boy, did I make a pay. Oh, yeah. So I stayed whenever all I did was go into the second hand, and I tell them, hey, I'm working overtime tonight. Okay, put down this book. That was the end of it. Well, they were told to do that, and there's no doubt about it. Anyway, I think that Bates has treated me as well as they can treat any human being in any company. And I'm very grateful to him. And I always, serving as a officer in the union, I always took responsibility for my people. They were my people, and I was going to take care of them. It's the same thing with the Bates thing today. They're still my people, and I'm still going to do all I can for them. It's as simple as that. Oh, when you put up your hand, you swear to do something, you better do it. It doesn't stop just because it starts to rain outside. It stops when you die, that's all. But you have an obligation for your life, just like the Army. You have an obligation for your life no matter where you are.
So, now, when you were both working, did you work the same shifts?
No, no.
Well, no, I work at the first shift.
The first shift, yeah.
And then I worked 10 years over there, and when I had my daughter, I quit. So he was working.
Yeah, I was working on the first shift then. Mm-hmm. Was that? I think so, yeah. When Bibby was born, yeah.
And you was on the second shift, and you like second shift better.
Yeah, I like second shift because I could work at home and sleep at the job. Yeah. No, just kidding, honey.
You could do a lot of work at the house. Around the house, you know, when it was working.
I did a lot of work on this
shift.
So. Oh, by the way, my wife lives downstairs and I live upstairs. That doesn't make you laugh.
It's true.
Yeah. I come down for dinner. And my bedroom is right there, but I have to pay her rent for it.
No, you got everything upstairs, yeah. You know, TV and everything, you know. Yeah. So, and then I can rest up and do my work, and yeah. I don't have to bother with it.
Yeah. Right.
If I want a pouch, she says, go pout upstairs.
So it's better like that for us.
Yeah. We've been having, I paid my mortgage in 16 years, with all that overtime. So I never rented after that. My daughter was in college in those days. Come upstairs, I had a nice bar with a little booze on it, you know, good stuff. But all my friends used to come over and we had a good time. Anyway, Susan come home with 8 of her friends. I didn't have no beds up there, but they all brought their bedrolls. And I had a nice bottle, brand new, of Johnny Walker. It left me a little bit out of the bond and fell of again. They had a good time for 3 days up there. But I was glad. They all came back when Susan got married. And we had a lot of fun with them.
When she got married, they all came over here.
Oh, yeah.
And they slept on the floor. They were all the bridesmaids.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
So they were all so.
They all had their bedrolls again. But I had one bed upstairs then. So. I think they slept 4 in that bed.
I think they slept most on the floor. It was all our friend from college.
Yeah. Nice bunch of kids.
Now, I'm really interested to know what it was like for you to grow up in such a huge family. Did you have a large house? How did you manage?
Well, we used to move. I don't know how many times we moved, you know. There was some bug, we have to move. There was some fire, we have to move. You know, there was always something. And we were all living on the fourth floor all the time. But I had a nice growing up, you know. I had a nice family. And went to school.
My mother was an angel.
My mother,
absolutely. That lady is waiting for us up there, I'm sure of it. What a wonderful human being.
She, I had my father and my mother all the time, you know. And I thought I had a nice life, you know.
Did some of your brothers and sisters stay in this area when they got older?
There's one who went to live in Connecticut. He died about 2 months ago there. Yeah. And there's, I have a sister in Quebec, she died there. And most of them, they live down here in Lewiston. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did any of them work in the mills as well?
Yeah,
most, not all of them.
But. Armand live, work in the mill on the Scargill.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that. Right, yeah.
And Pauline.
Pauline,
too.
Yeah. She worked in a Hill Mill for a little while there. Yeah. She was a battery hand. Yeah.
Yeah. And my brother.
Her brother used to work in a Continental.
They work in a shop. And Wilfred
was. Wilfred was in Continental.
Continental for a long time. And Leo, well, he died in the service. And Armand, he
died in Connecticut.
In Connecticut. It was 2 months ago. And but I still have Armand, Pauline. I still have two sisters that's living and a brother. So they're all going, you know. Yeah. And I have a sister that another. Three that died there in 2 months.
Oh, gosh.
There's one that died, and she was in Runford Community Home. She died 2 months ago. She was 93 years old.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all pretty old. Yeah. Armand was 89.
Yeah.
And we still got three sisters and a brother left. I was 14. They're all going.
Yeah. Now, you were a sewer. Was that your job in the mill?
I was a stitcher.
A stitcher.
Stitcher at Pepperell, you know.
And what can you talk about what it was like?
At the stitching?
Yeah.
Oh, I used to stitch on the sheep, you know. You know, the big ham.
Ham.
The ham.
Yeah.
And the small ham.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to, 40, we had to make... 40
sheep?
40 more than sheep. 40 dozen.
40 dozen a day?
A day. To make our minimum, you know. Yeah.
I never knew that.
But I like it. I like it over there. I thought it was a nice job. But some people used to make more than that.
I know that.
I wasn't the fastest one.
Wow. Did you make friends with the people you work with?
Oh, yes. I made friends. Oh, yes. There was three of my friends that died there, Judy, Rito, and Alice. And, oh yes, I make a lot of friends. Lucille Couillard.
Lucille, yeah.
She lived
in Massachusetts.
She went to live in Massachusetts. So, I like it over there. It was a very clean job, you know. Mm-hmm. Work on sheep. It wasn't
sure,
like... It wasn't like the shop. The shop...
All kind of cement.
All kind of cement, and the, but at over there, it was, I used to dress up a nice old dress. I didn't get dirty, you know. It was very nice. You know what they make over there now? They make canvas
awning. We bought one for the outside.
Yeah,
they came over yesterday to measure and everything.
I haven't been there for a long time, and this week we want to have a canopy put on. So I went over there and I saw a woman stitching, making canopy, you know.
Yeah.
Wow. So I was surprised to see that place again.
Did you have quotas that you had to meet? When you say 40 dozen a day, did you have to meet that or lose your job? Or how did that
if
work?
You could make 40 dozen there, that wasn't... they fire you sometimes, you know.
Yes.
But that was the quarter, the 40 dozen, you know.
Yeah.
But, but it used to go fast, you know. We had to go fast.
Was it easy to get injured doing that?
No, I don't think so.
Or did people sometimes?
Just like, did you ever sew? You never saw
a little bit.
Yeah, well, just like a sewing machine, you know.
Right.
And they used to come in a big rack, you know. I used to pull them like that and make them, you know. So It's a stitching job, you know. That's about all, I guess.
Is there anything else that you want to add about your time in the mills that I haven't asked you about?
I can't think of it, but no, I don't think so. I mean, the only thing is that I was always grateful for my job at the base. I made a good living at it, and I got along good with everybody that I met there. Executives or workers, it didn't make any difference. I got along just as well with the executives as I did with the union people, and I always tried to stay in the middle of it, instead of taking one side all the time.
Right.
Yeah. But we were there to protect the women's rights too, you know. Sometimes they gave jobs to women that was a little too heavy for them and stuff like that. And then they didn't do their quota. Well, the hell was raised. Shop Stewart got in trouble. And then we have to go to the front office and discuss it with the agent. So, and I work hard for the elections of Democrats all the time. The union was for Democrats. And they used to take me out of the mill for 2 months. And I'd work in the union office to get whatever the union, let's say the union's